PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Tim Fleming.
The whole point about Citizen Kane is that it's a film which keeps reminding you that it's a film. And that's exactly what audiences of the time didn't like. What they liked was the illusion of real life.
Actor Simon Callow tells us what went wrong with Orson Welles' career after Citizen Kane as we look at film on today's program. And we'll meet one of the movie industry's hottest new screenwriters, Zach Helm.
I would call and I would say, okay, there's this woman and she's an anarchist, but she's a baker. And she goes, oh, that's fantastic. What role does she play in the story? And I said, I don't know.
And we'll explore the important role that music played in the films of the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock. But first, Laura Poitras is a Peabody Award-winning documentary filmmaker. Her latest is called My Country, My Country. It's one of four documentaries about the war in Iraq that's contending for an Oscar nomination this year. The film looks at the question of whether it's possible to conduct democratic elections in a war zone. The documentary really took shape in Poitras's mind when she visited the Abu Ghraib prison, 20 miles west of Baghdad.
They gave me permission to film an inspection that was being conducted by a group of Iraqis, led by Dr. Riyad, who became the focus of the film. So he comes to the prison, I was there, and I introduced myself as an American documentary filmmaker, and I asked him if I could film him during the inspection, put a microphone on him and film him.
And you had not met him before?
Hadn't met him, and I was still looking for the characters, you know, that were going to become the film. I mean, the type of work I do is cinema verite, which, you know, for your listeners is telling stories through characters as things unfold. It's, you know, generally not using interviews, but following action as it happens. And so I said I was an American filmmaker, and he said, please, you know, we want transparency, and we want the world to know what's happening here. So then I filmed him, and I filmed him at the prison for about 2 hours, and there was about 2,500 men being detained at the prison at the time. And so he was talking to the men across, you know, razor wire and fence, and, you know, many of them had been there for over a year without any official charges. And then he's turning around and trying to explain to the U.S. military what the problems were. And, you know, one of the scenes that's in the film is when they discover a 9-year-old boy who's being held there. Yeah, a 9-year-old boy. And so he turns around and he explains to the U.S. soldier who's running the prison, you know, why that it's not okay to have a 9-year-old at Abu Ghraib prison.
This is type of punishment.
Yes.
This type of punishment, they can't beat it because they are children.
We have looked through every one of these files. These juveniles are dangerous.
And there was something in this conversation where you have an Iraqi turning around to, you know, explain to an American, you know, some basic, you know, principles of what is morally right and wrong. And he was just a great character.
Yeah, I can see why you began to find him appealing. What did you do next? Did you realize right then that this was the focus of your film?
Yeah, I mean, the type of filmmaking I do, you kind of get those kinds of instincts where, like, you know that this is something that, you know, it's a really, really special. And then he invited me to come to his medical clinic, which is in the neighborhood of Adamiya, which is a Sunni neighborhood. And he had a free medical clinic where people would come and bring their physical problems and then also, you know, talk about the situation, you know, the political situation. And as I was filming there, you know, if I had any doubts about, you know, him as really an extraordinary character, they evaporated. And what was really tremendous is that, you know, this was during a time when I was filming where very few Iraqis would even agree to go, you know, on record with print media, let alone have a camera follow them. And yeah, he ultimately invited me to stay in his home so I would live with him and his family and shoot.
This is very different from what you expected, I imagine, when you went to,
it is,
to
yeah,
Baghdad. I mean, you were going to be in the green zone. You were going to be following more or less the official line. This is something completely different.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be a film much more about America in Iraq, and which it still is. I really feel it is a film about the, you know, the American occupation of Iraq, but it's really told from an Iraqi perspective. And I think it would have been pretty unrealistic of me going in to think that I would have gotten the kind of access to a Sunni family that I ultimately did. Yeah. And I knew that once I had that access, that it was pretty extraordinary because there aren't many journalists who, you know, have been able to get into the homes. And also, to being a woman allowed me to film the dynamics in the family between the doctor and his wife and daughters.
You know, one of the things that's interesting is that we hear so much about how American journalists are unable to get out of the green zone and into a family. I mean, that's just extraordinary. Didn't you have any trouble with the authorities?
Well, first of all, I would say that actually there aren't many journalists inside the Green Zone, actually very, very few. I was one of the few people who actually had the kind of access I did. They're mostly living on compounds, protected compounds, but outside the Green Zone. They're not living in the Green Zone. But they also have been confined because of security situations to often their hotels or, you know, working with security. And I mean, there were certainly definite risks involved in terms of the way I worked, which was really to travel alone in the company of Dr. Riad or members of his family. But it also allowed me to really be very discreet in terms of moving in the city. So, you know, the precautions I took were, you know, I always wore a headscarf. And I also always, the footage that I shot at Abu Ghraib, I always carried with me because I felt that if I'd gotten myself in a bad situation, it was something that I could use to demonstrate what, you know, the work that I was doing.
Who else did you go see? Who were you searching for?
The film is, I mean, the story of the doctor, he is someone who's very critical of the U.S. occupation, but also decides to run for local office. So the real thread of the story is him as a protagonist and the election process. And as part of filming the elections, I also spend a lot of time filming the U.S. military and their preparations for it. So very high-level meetings, you know, in terms of elections preparations, where you see that most of the organization is, you know, a lot of the organizations and security is being conducted by the U.S. And then also the U.N. Electoral Assistance Committee that were brought there to work with Iraqis to administer the elections. And then I also spent time with a group of Australian contractors, security contractors, you know, guns for hire, who were brought in to protect election materials and drive them across the country. So I would travel with them as they went on convoys to move ballots and registration materials, you know, under heavy, heavy arms. And one of the scenes that's probably one of my favorite scenes in the film is the Australians buying guns, AK-47s, from a, you know, black market arms deal to protect election materials.
So the AK-47 normal, 200 to 250, where is it made? Which one?
We have Russian, also we have China.
Russian's better.
Of course.
Yeah. I'd like to have my people test fire them first, eh? To make sure they work.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Just to set the scene for the people who haven't seen your documentary yet, this is all leading up to the famous Purple Finger election.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And in fact, voter turnout for that, I mean, this is one of the great success stories, as the story was told here. Voter turnout in Iraq was higher there than ever here, as I understand it.
Yeah, the turnout was 58%, and that was with a Sunni boycott of the election. So, you know, people at great risk to their lives went to vote, and I think that's actually one of the, you know, lessons of the film. When we hear the U.S. administration and the government talking about us bringing democracy to Iraq and the Middle East, and then you realize that, you know, not only did they turn out and vote, but they did it, you know, with death threats and at higher levels than we do in this country.
Yeah. Of course, there's been a lot of media about Iraq over the last few years. In fact, your film is one of four documentaries about the Iraq War contending for Oscars this year. Does that surprise you?
I don't think it's surprising. I mean, you know, I mean, as artists working in these times, I mean, this is a really pivotal, crucial event in U.S. history. So it's not surprising that there would be documentary filmmakers who'd be compelled to look at this war and to look at it in a different way than you're going to get from the local or the nightly news or the front page of the paper, but to really try to understand it in some kind of a way that has, you know, historical, I guess, depth.
Is that what you see as the role of the political documentary?
I mean, I really approach it as an artist, you know, making films. I mean, I went there as an American with a sense of despair about the war and wanting to express something about that, and as a documentarian thinking that this is a war that's going to have repercussions for, you know, I think generations, and that it was pretty important to try to document what was happening now, you know, both to express something about it in the immediate and then in the longer term to have a document of it. So I think it's motivated more as an artist than as a quote-unquote political documentary.
Of course, you've obviously studied the art of the documentary. You've looked at a lot of them. You've seen what other people do. Do you see them as having changed over the years? Are political documentaries different now from what they used to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually a really great time for documentaries because I think with success of certain films like Spellbound and Mad Hot Ballroom or Michael Moore's work, what you have is films that really are good stories, and people are going to see them and paying money in theaters to go and see them because they know that they're going to see a story like that they expected seeing a narrative film. And I think that documentaries now are a little bit less preachy and educational, where I think that they'd gotten a bit of a you know, stuck in sort of a TV mode of, you know, like that they're good for you, but they're not actually very enjoyable experiences. And I think with the success of films in recent years, it's a really interesting time. And I think as a storyteller, to be able to tell stories that are not only significant politically, but also move people is something you can do. And people are doing more and more of.
You risked your life to do this. Did you do that consciously?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I feel this is a war. This is our war. I mean, this is a war of choice. It's a preemptive war. Thousands of Americans have died in this war, and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have died. And I felt that it was just really crucial to be able to have a history of it, and that the work that I do, I mean, I really feel like it's a privilege what I do. And the risk that I was seeing around me was so much greater than the risk that I was taking. But I think it's actually, we're living in times where, you know, it's not a time to sit back and let other people take sacrifices. I mean, if you can do something or say something, I think it's, you know, it's just a crucial time to do that.
What does the title mean? My country, my country. Where does that come from?
My country is Montani, Montani in Arabic, and it's the opening lines of the Iraqi national anthem. And it's sung in the film at one point when one of the doctor's daughters comes home on election day.
Laura Poitras is a documentary filmmaker. Her latest film, My Country, My Country, is on the shortlist for feature-length documentaries for the Academy Awards.
I made no campaign promises, because until a few weeks ago, I had no hope of being elected. Now, however, I have something more than a hope. And Jim Geddes has something less than a chance. Every straw vote, every independent poll shows that I'll be elected.
That's a clip from what is often considered to be the greatest movie ever made, Orson Welles' 1941 classic, Citizen Kane. The actor Simon Callow writes about the making of Citizen Kane and Welles' career after Kane in the second volume of his Orson Welles biography, Orson Welles Volume 2, Hello Americans. Simon Callow talked to Steve Paulson about Welles' career.
Certainly something went terribly wrong after Citizen Kane for Welles in Hollywood, because within 18 months of the release of that film, and Welles being acclaimed as the greatest living filmmaker, he only having made one film, and Kane being regarded as the absolute climax of cinematic art, he was unemployable in Hollywood.
So that view was present back then. I mean, because of course in recent decades, Citizen Kane is routinely rated the greatest film ever made. But that critical assessment was also there right after Citizen Kane came out?
There was almost complete unanimity in the acclaim it received. And, you know, of course, it had been delayed. Its release had been delayed while William Randolph Hearst and his cohorts tried to suppress it. But during that time, RKO very smartly showed the film to many journalists. And even before its release, they were telling us that it was the greatest movie that had ever been made, the sum of celluloid art so far. Of course, that made an impact on audiences in New York and in Los Angeles, but pretty well nowhere else in the country. And it was a catastrophic failure at the box office. Hmm. It was, in fact, known as box office poison, literally. I mean, audiences didn't just not go. When they went, they detested it, which is very understandable in a way because, you know, the whole point about Citizen Kane is that it's a film which keeps reminding you that it's a film. And that's exactly what audiences of the time didn't like. What they liked was the illusion of real life. That was supposed to be the beauty of cinema, was that it filmed real life, do you know?
Well, and the other piece of it is that Kane, the character Orson Welles plays, is not especially likable. So, I mean, just in purely movie-going terms, in some ways, it's a hard film to like.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think what's very striking about Citizen Kane is that it's the film that has made more people want to become filmmakers than any other, because you can sense Welles's joy in discovering the medium. That's the glory of Citizen Kane. I mean, I'm not decrying the content. There's certainly a very powerful theme there and a powerful message, so to speak. But what, above all, is the message is the medium. Everybody feels, when they've seen Kane, Oh, fantastic, Orson. You think that's a wonderful shot. God, what a great idea, don't you? I mean...
Oh, absolutely.
You don't submit, as it were, to the story being told. You're always aware of the storyteller.
Yeah. Now, the common view is that Orson Welles was crushed by Hollywood. The studios just could not handle his brashness and his genius. He was too big for Hollywood, and they had to cut him down to size. How accurate is that story?
Well, it's complex. Certainly, there was a faction at RKO and in Hollywood in general that longed for Welles's comeuppance. You know, he enraged a lot of the film community just by being there, really, by being this person from the theatre who had come to Hollywood, made all kinds of public statements about what Hollywood should be and shouldn't be, and then infuriatingly had made this film, which was in fact wonderful. Even his enemies tended to agree it was a wonderful movie. But within RKO, of course, there was a tremendously strong faction which simply said, look at the balance sheet. We can't afford this man. And RKO was in trouble anyway. However, to look at it from the other perspective, it is absolutely true that Welles did nothing at all, not only to ingratiate himself with Hollywood, but he did nothing at all to make sure that he was fully cooperating with his own supporters. And the most important of his supporters was the head of RKO Studio, who was a man called George Schaefer. And it was George Schaefer who'd brought Welles to Hollywood, George Schaefer who'd given him that extraordinary contract, George Schaefer who fought almost within an inch of his professional life for Citizen Kane, which, as everybody probably knows, a lot of people wanted to actually destroy, not merely to prevent it from being released, but actually to destroy the physical film. And George Schaefer fought for Welles. So you would have thought Welles would have seen that he had a real supporter and collaborator in Schaefer, but he never treated him as such. And when Schaefer begged him, for example, to return from Brazil, where he was making a film called It's All True, to complete work on The Magnificent Amazons, Welles more or less ignored him. Hmm. Now, that's just not sensible behavior.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a competing story that Welles was inherently self-destructive. He set himself up for failure. And I mean, going back to his second movie, The Magnificent Ambersons, I mean, a lot of people were thinking, oh my God, if he could do that with Citizen Kane, this is going to be his true masterpiece, yeah. The Magnificent Ambersons. And then he finishes shooting. He goes off to Brazil on some rather strange mission. We can talk about that later, while the final cut is being made. And it's essentially destroyed by the studios.
Well, this is the point. You're absolutely right. But the point is that Citizen Kane is what it is, as much because of what happened in post-production, after the film had been shot, as for what it was when it was being shot. I mean, it's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant piece of shooting by Greg Toland, brilliantly lit, brilliantly staged, etc. But what gives it its extraordinary tone, in the end, was done in post-production. And you would have thought Welles would think, oh, right, that's, you know, that's a good lesson. I must make sure that I have a lot of time for post-production for The Magnificent Ambersons. But in fact, he more or less felt that having shot it, he'd finished it, which is a strange mistake for him to have made. Then he went to Brazil, and he was supposed to go to Brazil. The point is that Pearl Harbor occurred during the end of the shooting of Magnificent Ambersons, and immediately America declared war, and everybody wanted to contribute to the war effort, not least Welles himself.
So, okay, well, that all makes sense, but then he started getting reports that the editing of The Magnificent Ambersons was not going well. It was being ruined, and you would think any sensible person would rush back to Hollywood and try to defend his film to save it, but he didn't do that.
No. What happened is that Welles and his editor, Robert Wise, who later, of course, became a famous film director of The Sound of Music, amongst other things, Robert Wise and Welles had agreed on more or less a cut of the film, and that is more or less what was shown at the first preview of the film in a town called Pomona in California. Let me just stress as an important contrast between the way Citizen Kane and Magnificent Ambersons were handled that Citizen Kane was never subjected to previews. It was subjected, as I said, to the private viewings of journalists, who then wrote very nicely about it. But it was never exposed to the general public. And if it had been exposed to the general public, I dare say the reactions would have been very much like the reactions to The Magnificent Ambersons. However, with this additional factor, that, of course, America was at war. And here was a film that Wells had chosen and Schaefer had chosen to be as uncontroversial as possible. They didn't want another Citizen Kane. They didn't want another political film. So they chose this magnificent novel by Booth Tarkington, this grand novel of Midwest life, in Indiana life, and it depicts the decline of American gentry and the lamentable rise of industrialization. Well, put that in front of a preview audience, basically of university kids, shortly after America has joined in the Second World War, and you can expect exactly what happened, which is that they absolutely despised it. Especially it was on a double bill with another film about America going to war, very exuberant film about America going to war, and a personal appearance by James Cagney. Now, they were all for James Cagney, they were all for the war film, and, of course, they despised and detested The Magnificent Amazons. RKO got incredibly panicked and said, we've got to cut it because it's too long, but also we've got to lighten it up and brighten it up. We can't have all this somberness. And amazingly enough, a lot of Wells's collaborators agreed with them. Joseph Cotten, who's not only, you know, had acted with Wells, but was Wells's best friend nominally, and the guy who ran Wells's office, Jack Moss, and various others all said, and Schaefer said, yes, it's right. It's too dark. And so then they started the process, the catastrophic process of cutting it and of reshooting it and rescoring it. And Wells was kept apprised of all of this, but as you say, it is really astonishing that he didn't just say, okay, I'm getting on the next plane out.
So why didn't he?
I think that he simply believed that in some weird way he was protected, you know, that his star would not be extinguished. I think Kane might have given him a certain feeling. Lots of people think that Kane daunted Wells, that he could never repeat it. I disagree. What I think is that Wells felt omnipotent as a result of Kane, because not only had it been acclaimed absolutely universally, but he defeated William Randolph Hearst. The fact that it did no business didn't matter to Wells at all, because money, you know, meant nothing. Wells had no concept at all of money. All he knew was that it was a huge, triumphant success. And I think he thought, oh, they couldn't really do damage to this from me, the director of Citizen Kane. I think there was that in the back of his mind. But when they started giving him absolute details about what they were cutting, he kept saying, I don't think any of this is right. And this, I think, is what you should cut. And frankly, one isn't exactly impressed by the things that Wells wanted to cut either. He seemed to want to cut some of the best things in the movie. It just points to the fact that you can't possibly edit a film by remote control.
Well, you get the sense that in some ways the final product may not have mattered to him so much. I mean, the joy he took, the creative energy he got was in the making of the movie itself. I mean, really the shooting of the movie. And maybe I'm reading too much into this, but it's almost as if polishing it, turning it into a gem, was not the most important thing for him in the end.
That became increasingly so. I think that that's something that developed more as the years went by, especially in his last, say, 20 years. I think he became purely an experimental filmmaker, and he'd do one of those commercials for Paul Masson in order to hire a camera, a group of actors, a studio for a week or so, and shoot a bit of a movie just to see what it would be like. And I honour him for that. I think that's fascinating. He becomes to me like an alchemist in his laboratory, just testing things out, trying things out. And it was his lament from the moment he went to Hollywood that experiment was impossible in Hollywood. Nobody would allow you to explore the medium. And that's what he did, really. He, in the end, devoted his life to exploring the medium. What we make of his explorations or his experiments is another matter. But the fact that he did that, he engaged in that activity, I find quite exhilarating.
Actor Simon Callow. He's the author of Orson Welles Volume 2, Hello Americans. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Do you think that Citizen Kane's the greatest film ever made? Is it even the greatest film Orson Welles ever made? We'd love to know what you think. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, the importance of being creative. A profile of one of today's brightest young screenwriters, Zach Helm, as we continue to focus on film. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. One day, an IRS auditor named Harold Crick wakes up to discover a voice in his head. A female voice, narrating his life. It's the premise of the film Stranger Than Fiction, starring Will Ferrell, Dustin Hoffman, and Emma Thompson. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon often says he hears voices in his head, so he seemed like the perfect choice to produce this story about the screenwriter behind Stranger Than Fiction. Zach Helm talks about the art of screenwriting.
It took Zach Helm a while to develop the premise for the Stranger Than Fiction screenplay.
I called Lindsay Duran, who I had been friends with for a long time and was a producer of another script of mine. I called her immediately and I said, Lindsay, I have an idea for a movie. There's a guy who wakes up and he has a narrator. And she goes, oh, that's really funny. I go, yeah, isn't it? She goes, yeah. She goes, but it's not really a movie. And I sort of laughed and I said, okay. And a couple weeks later, I called her and I said, okay, he has a narrator and the narrator is narrating the minutiae of his day and therefore ruining his day.
Harold just counted brush strokes.
All right, who just said Harold just counted brush strokes?
She goes, that's even funnier and it's still not a movie. And then a few weeks later, I called her and I said, okay, the narrator is narrating his life and then it says he's going to die. And she paused and she goes, okay, that's a movie.
Dave, I'm being followed.
How are you being followed? You're not moving.
It's by a woman's voice. She's narrating.
Oh.
Harold couldn't concentrate on his work.
I can't think while you're talking.
You have a voice speaking to you.
About me, accurately, and with a better vocabulary.
Harold found himself exasperated.
Shut up!
Cursing the heavens in futility.
No, I'm not. I'm cursing you, you stupid voice! So shut up and leave me alone!
Once Helm figured out the storyline, he still had a lot of work ahead of him. Especially since he didn't write the scenes in the order in which they appear in the film.
I try not to be precious about the words. I try to find the right ones, and, you know, sometimes that means I have to fail. I have to make mistakes. And so I allow myself to do that. And in the process of that, I just sort of stayed in touch with Lindsay, and I would call, and I would say, one of the characters is Harold's wristwatch. And she goes, oh, that's fantastic. What does it do? And I said, I don't know yet. I haven't written it. Yeah. Or I would call and I would say, okay, there's this woman and she's an anarchist, but she's a baker. And she goes, oh, that's fantastic. What role does she play in the story? And I said, I don't know.
Helm's story is about an IRS auditor played by Will Ferrell. He's trying to track down his inner narrator in what is one of the most original and intelligent films in recent years. Hey, I just got a great idea.
For a moment, Doug Gordon entertained the notion of having a narrator describe what he was doing as he put together this story. But then, Doug Gordon realized it was a bad idea.
After Harold's narrator informs him that he's going to die, he tries to get help from Professor Jules Hilbert, played by Dustin Hoffman.
Question one. Has anyone recently left any gifts outside your home? Anything, gum, money, a large wooden horse?
I'm sorry?
Just answer the question.
No.
Do you find yourself inclined to solve murder mysteries in large, luxurious homes to which you... Let me finish. To which you may or may not have been invited.
No.
Right. On a scale of 1 to 10, what would you consider the likelihood you might be assassinated?
Assassinated?
1 being very unlikely, 10 being expecting it around every corner.
I have no idea.
Let me rephrase. Are you the king of anything?
Like what?
Anything. King of the lanes at the local bowling alley.
King of the lanes?
King of the lanes. King of the trolls.
King of the trolls?
Yes. A clandestine land found underneath your floorboards.
Anything? No.
Huh?
No. It's ridiculous.
Agreed. But let's start at ridiculous and move backwards.
Professor Hilbert advises Harold to find out if he's in a comedy or a tragedy, which led me to wonder, does Zach Helm see his life as a comedy or a tragedy?
I look at my life as being, you know, it's been a comedy recently. I tend to look at my life, I think, through a very optimistic viewpoint. As far as the story was concerned, we knew that we were having to walk a tightrope between comedy and tragedy. And part of the fun for me was if I could make a film in which the audience didn't know if what they were watching was one thing or the other thing. And to try to pull that off was sort of the big stunt for us to see if we could really get audiences invested in both kinds of stories. And so because of that, what's great is that I still hear reactions from people who wish that it ended differently. Or, you know, wish that something else happened or whatnot. And more than it just being critical of the film or being negative about the film, it's really about them being invested in one story and one sacrifice more than the other, and their personal inclination towards comedy or tragedy. So you actually learn a lot about people based on that reaction.
Helm originally studied theater. After executives from the Fox studio saw Helm's play, they invited him to join Fox 2000, a year-long development program in which Helm received a weekly salary, and everything that he wrote became the property of Fox. This was back in 1998. In just 2 weeks, Helm wrote a screenplay sample called Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium. It's the story of a 243-year-old toy store owner who leaves his business to a young, insecure manager. Unfortunately, there was a personnel change at Fox 2000, and the studio brought in a new screenwriter to rewrite Helm's original script.
That was heartbreaking because it was my first script, because it meant so much to me. The idea that somebody else was writing my baby was very, very difficult for me. And without losing any sense of grace, Fox 2000, trying to be diplomatic, actually sent me a ham as compensation. I think they felt bad and they thought I was handling it professionally, I guess. It was around the holidays. And I realized that I probably was not in the place that I actually wanted to be as far as my career. And so not only did I stop allowing my scripts to be rewritten, but I knew that I couldn't rewrite other people as well, that if I felt this horrible about what was going on, there were other writers out in the world whose work I was massacring. So turnaround is fair play.
Helm has tattoos on both of his wrists. The tattoos are solid black bands or cuffs between 2.5 and 3 inches thick. They serve as a visible reminder of the separation between Helm's work and his life. Why is that so important to him?
I am constantly trying to be as critical as I possibly can of the work that I'm doing, not in a negative way necessarily, but hopefully in a very honest way. And the best way that I can do that is to detach myself from the work itself. I don't necessarily look at the act of writing as being a form of creation necessarily, as much as I feel as though I'm interpreting or playing or experimenting. And in order to do that, I have to be able to step away from the work a little bit. And so it's sort of a nice reminder that I am not necessarily made of the things that I write.
Whenever Helm submits a screenplay, he also includes a CD full of music that acts as a kind of soundtrack for the reader. This is not something most screenwriters do.
I find screenplays to be a very difficult medium in which to create an environment or an ambiance for a reader or an audience. They can be a little blueprinty. And as much as I can, I want to try to create something that will evoke emotion from whoever it is that's coming in contact with it. So if it's a reader, I want to make an experience for them beyond just the words on the page. So part of that is the CD, which will have songs which sort of match or invoke the emotions that are going on in the scene or work as score or what have you. It started because of a script that I wrote a few years ago called The Disassociate, in which there was a dance number, of all things. And the joy of the dance number was that it was to a song that really shouldn't be danced to, which is this Donovan song called Barabajoggle. I'm a huge Donovan fan. I have no idea what any of his lyrics ever mean. Here's Barabajoggle, which is a very fun, silly song, and this couple is dancing to it. And I knew that the scene was sort of funny when you read it, but if anyone was familiar with Barabajoggle, it was really funny. And I couldn't count on everyone reading the script knowing what Barabajoggle was. So I decided, well, I'm going to put that on a CD so people can listen to it, and then they'll know, and then they'll understand how, you know, how the scene actually works. And when I did that, I realized that what I was doing was trying to create the sort of environment around the reader, and that it was only going to flesh out more of the script if I did that.
Truth is more time.
Zach Helm is the author of the screenplay for Stranger Than Fiction. The screenplay has been published as Stranger Than Fiction, The Shooting Script. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon spoke to Helm. And don't be surprised if Helm's screenplay is nominated for an Oscar. Zach Helm recently finished directing his first film, Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium, based on his first screenplay. That movie is scheduled to open in November. In Stranger Than Fiction, Emma Thompson plays Harold Crick's narrator. If you were to have someone narrate your life and you could choose the narrator, who would it be? You can send us your thoughts through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, one of the most memorable creative partnerships in the history of film, director Alfred Hitchcock and composer Bernard Herrmann. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. The first time he saw Alfred Hitchcock's 1958 classic Vertigo, Jack Sullivan says that the film's music blew him out of his chair. That cinematic experience definitely planted the seed for Sullivan's new book, Hitchcock's Music. Jack Sullivan talked to Anne Strainchamps about the important role that music played in the Master of Suspense's movies.
Music is almost like a preternatural force in Hitchcock's films. It kind of hovers over the action, influencing it for good or ill. It's certainly not background. It's certainly not supposed to be unobtrusive. In something like The Man Who Knew Too Much, the music is the occasion of an assassination, and then at the end of the film saves the heroine's life. A song saves a life in Rear Window. The music in Psycho, I think, is almost like a force of aggression. Almost every single Hitchcock film presents music either as something that is deeply psychological or as a force that actually changes the course of the plot. In The 39 Steps and The Lady Vanishes, for an example, the music is actually a secret code that allows the Allies to thwart the forces of fascism. So it can be a force in the actual storyline, or it can be a deeply psychological force. Hitchcock called it the psychological use of music, where music expresses the unspoken, which means that music can actually say things the characters can't say or don't even know.
So for a film director, Hitchcock had a very sophisticated understanding of music, but he had a collaborator in all of this. Some of his most memorable film scores were composed by a guy named Bernard Herrmann. What was their working relationship like?
Well, it went from ideal to very, very sour at the end, but for the most part, it was ideal. Both of them were so deeply simpatico that Hitchcock would actually invite Bernard Herrmann onto the set and consult with him even before scenes were shot, which is very unusual.
Now, who was Bernard Herrmann, and where did he come from? How did the two meet?
He was a composer, an American composer from Brooklyn. Unlike most of Hitchcock's composers were emigres like himself. He was a symphonic composer and an opera composer as well as a film composer, and he wanted to be recognized as an important symphonic composer instead of a movie guy. But what happened was the scores for Vertigo and Psycho in particular became so iconic that ironically he became known mainly as a film composer, even though he does have important and very beautiful concert works. But people usually don't ever hear them.
So let's talk about a few of the classic Hitchcock-Herman collaborations. First of all, the 1958 film Vertigo, which a lot of people think is a really classic film score. What makes Vertigo so special?
Because it perfectly embodies what Vertigo is about, which is obsession. The minute Bernard Herrmann's main title begins, the Vertigo Prelude, it just grabs you by the throat, and it's this kind of circling, repetitive figure that really does sound like a very deep obsession, and it continues coursing through the film practically from beginning to end. It's the film that Hitchcock asked Herrmann for more music than he'd ever requested before, and it obviously meant something very deep to Herrmann because he wrote some of the most powerful music he'd ever written for any film. Hitchcock said in several instances, "We'll just have the camera and you," and there are long stretches of Vertigo that have no dialogue. All those wonderful scenes with Jimmy Stewart circling, looking for Madeline in his car, the so-called dressing scene at the end, where Hitchcock was able to return to what he called pure cinema, which is just image and sound without dialogue. And I think it's the one movie that's impossible to even imagine without its music.
Mm-hmm. There's a famous chord in it too, isn't there?
Well, people call it the Vertigo chord, and it really is, it does induce vertigo. And unfortunately, some people at the studio were terrified that people wouldn't know what Vertigo meant. And so they asked Livingston Evans, the team that did Que Sera Sera for Doris Day, for The Man Who Knew Too Much, to compose a song called Vertigo that would explain what Vertigo meant. And this was a really close call because that song almost got used in place of Herrmann's magnificent prelude, and it would be very depressing if they had done that. But fortunately, Hitchcock kicked it out at the last second.
Didn't some people think that the music was actually too intense, that it kind of set the audiences up to expect something that was much more horrific than the movie actually was?
Well, I write in the book that my theory is that one reason Vertigo was a flop, and it was a flop, and now it's an iconic masterpiece, was simply that 50s audiences weren't used to, well, first of all, they weren't used to seeing Jimmy Stewart have a nervous breakdown on camera and be put in the lunatic asylum. They weren't used to that, but they weren't used to something that began with such a riveting musical scenario that it raised that kind of expectations and then kind of deepened into a very subtle psychodrama that in some sections is actually quite slow. But I think that's right. I think the music really sets you up for something that now people are perfectly happy to go with, but in the 50s it didn't quite come off.
Now, another famous Hitchcock-Herrmann collaboration is the 1960 shocker Psycho. And one of the unusual things about that score is that Herrmann used only stringed instruments. Why did he decide that, do you know?
Well, I'd like to say that he was just brilliant enough to want to invert all the usual cliches about strings connoting romance and lushness. But part of it was just budgetary. Hitchcock shot that film with his black and white television crew for Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and it was a project he did completely in secret. Nobody even knew. I mean, Janet Leigh told me that nobody knew what the project was about at all. Sort of like the movie, that everybody has a deadly secret. So Herrmann couldn't afford a large orchestra. So that was part of the reason, but he called it black and white music for a black and white film, mm-hmm. Herman did, and I think it really does come off that way.
Now, at first, according to your book, Psycho almost didn't happen, and it was Herman's music that really kind of saved the film.
Yes, it was an unusual story, and it just shows how important Hitchcock's music was. Hitchcock, after an initial burst of enthusiasm for Psycho, became gradually more depressed by the film. He thought there was something missing, something that was flat, something that just didn't come off at all. And he told Herman that he was thinking about cutting it up and just putting it onto Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And what happened was Herman told Hitchcock, go away for your Christmas vacation. When you come back, we'll talk about it again. Because Herman really thought this was a brilliant film, and that he was very shocked that Hitchcock even had the thought of doing this. So he composed the shower cue in secret against Hitchcock's wishes. Hitchcock wanted that scene to be silent. And so when Hitchcock came back, he sat him down and he played the version that was silent. And then he played the version with his music. And Hitchcock just looked at him and said, well, of course, my boy, that's what we'll do. And that really got him very animated again. And according to Joseph Stefano, who was the screenwriter for Psycho, Joe told me that he was watching the dailies as they came in, and he too thought the film was really not very good, that there was something lacking. And he said one day Hitchcock summoned him to a private screening with no one else there and played the version with the music, because he wanted Joe to hear it, because Joe himself had been a composer before he was a screenwriter. And Joe told me the minute the music came on, he just fell out of his chair. And he
so did a lot of audience members later.
Right. And when they played it for the production people, they all fell out of their chairs. And then all of us, I remember being a little kid, I did as well.
Yeah, I remember not wanting to come out from under the chair.
Right. Exactly.
Well, that sort of foreshadows one of the last collaborations of Herman and Hitchcock on the sound design for The Birds, because that's a film that actually doesn't really have a traditional musical film score. It's got, electronic sound effects, bird music the whole way through?
It's just astonishing, isn't it? Here's a film so ahead of its time, like so many of Hitchcock's films, ostensibly has no music, and yet it has maybe the most original score, if we can call it that, of any Hitchcock film. It's all electronic, mingled with actual bird sounds. And one of the things Hitchcock loved about The Birds was that he could plan every single sound just the way he storyboarded every image in advance. And in Hollywood, in the archives, I found Hitchcock's music notes for The Birds, and it's a 9-page, very meticulous document that he wrote himself that describes every single sound in the film. And they're all scored with very loud, slightly loud, or subliminal bird sounds, and he describes what everyone sounds like, and you watch the film, and they really do sound that way.
So you mean he was really scoring those bird sounds the way you would music? I mean, he was paying attention to rhythm and pattern, texture,
exactly.
Volume, timbre, all the dynamics.
Texture, all those, especially dynamics. And he loved the birds because he was such a control freak that he could really control that. You can't really control what a composer is going to do, but he could control every single sound because it was electronic.
So how many sounds went into that?
Well, if you watch the film carefully, you'll see that every single bird attack has a completely different timbre to it, from very low and brooding at the end when you have that mysterious, very beautiful non-closure ending, to very subtle whirrings, I think, during the sparrow attack, to these shrieking, terrifying, psycho-like noises when the crows attack. Everyone sounds different, and they're described as if they're music in Hitchcock's notes.
So Bernard Herrmann wasn't writing music for this film. What did he do? Did he have a role in the music?
Well, he liked to think that he was the composer because he was giving technical advice throughout the film. And The Birds was one of the, I think, background sort of ominous rumbles in the breakup between Hitchcock and Herman, because Herman didn't think he got enough credit for The Birds, and he went around telling people that he wrote the music, whereas Hitchcock really thought that he, Alfred Hitchcock, was the auteur for that film, as far as all the sounds were concerned.
Hmm.
They really had a clash of egos.
Eventually, the two of them stopped working together. What happened? Those two egos
well, it was
just
right
got
after
too big?
That. John Williams, who was Hitchcock's last composer, told me that he thought it was like two matadors just butting up against each other. Very stubborn guys, both perfectionists, both very independent, and that worked very well for them for a long time. And then finally, it came to a head during Torn Curtain, which was a disaster in the making, which Hitchcock divined it would be from the very beginning, and he wanted Herman to do something that would help promote the movie. He was under pressure to produce something hip, something modern, and Herman turned in one of these bleak, modernistic, pounding scores for something like 11 flutes and 9 French horns. And it was not what Hitchcock wanted, and he fired him on the spot right after the Torn Curtain prelude was played by the orchestra, right in front of all his colleagues, and humiliated him in public, and that they never spoke to each other after that.
Is there a particular scene? I mean, I know you've watched hundreds, and so this is maybe not a kind question to ask you, but is there a particular scene from one of his movies that just really jumps out as, say, just a signature Hitchcockian musical moment?
Well, one of the ones that jumps out to me, and it just sounds like a small thing, but the schoolyard scene in The Birds, I mean, the only music you have are school children singing Rissledy Rossledy, this very kind of charmingly tedious and endless repetitive tune. And that's what Hitchcock called counterpoint, where the music does one thing and what's on the screen does something the opposite that sets up this amazing tension. That one jumps out at me as something that's very Hitchcockian and that only he would have conceived.
Jack Sullivan is the author of Hitchcock's Music. He spoke with Anne Strange Champs. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 114A, Screenshots. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.